that the government decided to find a way to pay back all the external debt. And the way how they did that was that they basically starved their own citizens. They cut down the heating, they cut down the electricity, they cut down the food and everything. So it became a very dark and dire time.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app so that you don't miss out on future episodes. Emanuela Gramma was born in the mid-1970s in a small provincial town in eastern Romania. She provides us with some great insight into life in the Romanian provinces during the 1980s. She lived in a small two-bedroom flat and tells of her parents working in a factory while her grandparents looked after her. Her father listened secretly to Radio Free Europe and collected stamps so that he could legitimately write to people in the West. Her parents told her not to talk at school about what was said at home and to be very careful what she said to her friends. Emanuela vividly recalls the day the revolution started in 1989. She was at home alone and she describes the instant atmosphere of change and the weeks and months thereafter. We also hear about Emanuela's book, Socialist Heritage, The Politics of Past and Place in Romania. Now, I'm asking listeners to support my work to enable me to continue recording these quite frankly incredible stories. If you become a monthly supporter via Patreon, you will get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you are helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. If you can't wait for next week's episode, do visit our Facebook discussion group where guests and listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. James Chilcott is our host for this week's episode, so I'm delighted to welcome James and Emanuela to our Cold War conversation.
I was born in Romania in the summer of 1975. The end of the regime, I basically grew up throughout the late communist period. I am currently now a professor of history and anthropology at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, the U.S. And I've been living in the U.S. for almost 20 years.
So you were born in 75 in Romania. Whereabouts in Romania were you born, and what was it like, the area where you lived?
So I was born in a small provincial town in eastern Romania. That town is called Focșani. It's just the quintessence of a provincial town. It was relatively small, around maybe not so small, but definitely small by the standards of a city. It was just an ordinary town whose history, I have to admit, was rather an unknown history to me at the time when I was growing up. What I mean by that is that much later, when I started actually conducting research in Romania and doing interviews and also reading other, you know, materials about Romania at the interwar time, it turned out that my own hometown turned out to be a town with a significant Jewish population that left after the Second World War. And so there was this history that I actually learned about much later in my adulthood. So there were many somehow hidden histories of this town that seemed to be very homogeneous from an ethnic perspective of the time I was growing up.
Was that history talked about while you were growing up? Was it part of the socialist academic curriculum?
No, not at all. Definitely not. So first of all, from my personal experience, I never heard about the presence of the Jewish people in my town until much, much later, maybe 20 years or I don't know, 15 years later. Definitely at the time when I started doing my PhD and started really learning about it. Also, during the time of my growing up, no one would really mention the histories of the Romanian Jews. This was definitely a taboo topic. Very few people would talk about. All the history that we learned in school was very much focusing on Romanian history, right? It was very much part of the context in which the Ceausescu led the government focused highly on developing, a history, a socialist history with heavy nationalist tones. And therefore, anything that was taught in school was about Romania and Romanians. The fact that Romania was had a history, a much more complex history of heterogeneous ethnic heterogeneity and the presence of a large Jewish population as well as other minority ethnic groups was not something much mentioned during my education.
And tell me more about your education. Was it a very formal system? Was there much selectivity as you went through? Or was it a fairly preordained path when you started out?
Oh, it was a fairly preordained part in the sense that everyone white would just follow a rhythm of life that was relatively ordinary because, right, that was the only ordinariness that would be, imaginable to each Romanian citizen who was living at that time. The possibility of leaving the country almost did not exist. It was very hard for people it was really impossible for a Romanian citizen to get a passport to visit, Western countries, especially if you didn't have the so-called connections, that is very special ways in which to obtain this passport. But for an ordinary person without such connections, this was rather impossible. So which means that the education that anyone would have, I'm talking about from my perspective as a child, was nothing special about it. But what I'm trying to say is it was what other people would do. And the possibility of trying to do something else or imagining something else was rather within the horizon.
So you used a very interesting expression, the rhythm of life. What was the rhythm of life like for you and your family? Was it a fairly happy path or did your parents have particular views about the regime which they had to hide? What was that rhythm of life like for you and for you as a family?
So I will have to say that my parents were rather ordinary people. They both were smart people, but at the same time, for instance, neither of them went to college. So they both went to technical schools. And then they found a job as a white-collar job in a factory in the city. So there was not much they got married and they had me. And then basically my grandparents were helping they were helping them a lot raising me. So
is that quite normal for grandparents to play a big part in looking after the children while the parents went to work?
Especially at that time, I would say, absolutely. It was like, we were definitely a generation. So the generation that I was part of was a generation of that was described in Romanian as the generation with the key around their neck. What that means exactly is that many of the kids who did not have grandparents living in the same town or the same setting as their parents meant that they would come back from school with holding the key of their apartment around their neck so they wouldn't lose it. They would open the door of their apartment. They would get in. They would make sure they will eat something. They will do homework by themselves. Then maybe get out in front of the apartment building and start playing with other kids who also have their kids around their necks until basically the parents will show up from work, which was around 4 or 5. So the so-called after school that many, many kids right now are part of as a way of really continuing education and finding, you know, a structure for the time in between ending the end of school and the time when parents finish work, was in fact, taking care of yourself for many of these kids. My situation was particular precisely because my parents were able, or they chose, not to go somewhere else, which meant that they lived in the same town with my grandparents. And automatically my grandparents were able to, I mean, I lived most of the time with my grandparents. I lived there, especially during the winters with my grandparents, because they had a house, which was very unusual for that time, which meant that they were able to heat up the house independently, right? With they had wooden stoves and they were able to do so. This is particularly important at the time in Romania when early 1980s. So I was already six, right? Five, six. So this is, I'm jumping out now to a broader context. So Ceausescu, the leader of the country, decided to stop paying to the government decided to find a way to pay back all the external debt. And the way how they did that was that they basically starved their own citizens. They cut down the heating, they cut down the electricity, they cut down the food and everything. So it became a very dark and dire time. Many people were like freezing in their apartments because the heat was not available. And anyone who live in an apartment building will be dependent on the heat from the state, with the exceptions of the people who had their own houses and were able to heat up the houses in independent ways. So my grandparents were one of, were part of this much smaller category of people. And consequently, I basically lived my entire, five months per year up to 4 years with my grandparents.
Why were they lucky enough to have a house?
Oh, yes. This is a very important point, too. So I will just for the, I am also a historian. I'm also someone who experienced that time. I also, I'm moving in between contexts. So I'm moving from my personal experience to a broader context. So the broader context that we have to be aware of when we understand the situation is that, so the socialist government in Romania tried very hard to radically change the urban texture of the cities. They the point of transforming the urban fabric into socialist modern cities was a key point on the political agenda. What happened is that they had to really change a lot because most of the smaller cities were very much formed as individual houses and less apartment with much fewer apartment buildings. In my specific town, there were no apartment buildings right before the Second World War, and they started building these new apartment buildings by demolishing all the individual houses. My parents lived in a neighborhood where they would see the bulldozers in other neighborhoods coming closer and closer and closer and closer. And for many years, almost decades, they lived in the fear that these bulldozers will eventually get on their street, they will demolish their house, and then them and all their other neighbors would actually be moved forcefully into living in apartment buildings. So they were lucky that didn't happen. But they were lucky in many respects. So this is how it happened for me to be able to also live in a house throughout the communist times.
Was it luck, or was it connections, or was it heritage or something they'd done in the past that enabled them to be in that fairly privileged position?
I would say it was was rather luck. It was, so what's fascinating when I, you have to imagine the picture of apartment buildings being rising as we speak. You can see the more and more new apartment buildings rising that you can see from my grandparents' courtyard. And eventually, by the time of the end of the regime in 1989, there were two streets that separated my grandparents' street and, of course, the house from that, from the new apartment buildings. So I would say it was luck because, it was necessarily, or as far as I know, there were no connection. What happened is that the, local authorities focus on specific areas in the city. They demolished neighborhoods and then they build apartment buildings. So somehow the small neighborhood where my grandparents lived became caught in between two modern neighborhoods of apartment buildings. So perhaps they were just postponed in terms of, this specific neighborhood to be eventually demolished and radically changed.
And you mentioned that, you know, after these children had gone home and they sorted themselves out, they go outside in front of their apartment block and play. When you weren't at school, what did you do in your spare time?
So I would play and I would read. I also have to say that yet another important part of the socialist education in Romania was that during 1970s, there was definitely a strategic opening towards the West. It was encouraged politically. Let me actually rephrase it. Mid to late 60s, early 70s. During that time, there were a lot of translations done into Romanian from Western literature, world literature. So there were an amazing range of literature, fiction, nonfiction, books translated from this world literature into Romanian. So if you really wanted to read, you could really read a lot and become familiar with Western literature, especially. So
was that a very curated list of books, and who decided what books was appropriate to translate?
That's a very good question. I don't have the answer for that, right? I'm a researcher. I want to make sure I base my answers. But based on the variety of options, I would say it was less politically curated, if this is what you mean. So I basically read Honoré de Balzac, right? When I was 10, I read the entire Balzac. And then I moved to Victor Hugo and then to Alexandre Dumas. And then, so there was no such a sense the genre of young adult literature. I mean, that did not exist. So you basically moved from reading kids' book to, like, if you are interested, to just adult fiction. You just read all the fiction possible. And that's what I was doing. I had a lot of fun reading, a lot. I remember that. If I can just develop this a bit more. I had school from 1 to 4th grade in the morning. But then once I switched to middle school, right, 5th grade to 8th grade, I started going to school in the afternoon. Because the idea was that there were not so many classrooms, so the classrooms had to be used twice per day to accommodate all the children and their needs. So I would go to school at 12, and I would come back around 4 or 5 together with my parents who were coming back from work. But what I was doing in every morning when they were actually leaving for work, I had 4 hours per day when I was reading only fiction, because I had done my homework in the night before, and I would just be happy to read. And that's exactly what I did. I read like nuts, basically, for 4 years of my life before I went to high school and before basically the regime collapsed.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
So that was basically an advantage to you, that liberalizing of the access to literature. You're a big beneficiary of that.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, yes. And I wasn't, right? I wasn't speaking English then. I was not able to read in other languages at that moment. So the only thing I would be able to read was Romanian. And I read every book I could find.
And in terms of your experience at school, was that a very formal experience? Was it all, were you wearing uniforms? Was it, how much freedom of speech did you have? What was it like as a school system?
Yeah, so definitely everyone was wearing uniforms. I mean, we were still part of the pioneers, the young pioneers generation. We had to have our own, special little red tie. So everyone had to wear uniforms. That was totally out of question to even consider wearing something else. Like, you basically would be kicked out of school. That would not be possible. I do remember very specifically that sometimes they would come in and they would have special official visits, not necessarily like really big shots in the political apparatus, but more like regional or local, officials. And at that moment, the director of the school will come, the principal will come in every classroom and make sure everyone had, every girl will wear this kind of, white hairband. And then every boy would have, the shirt very well tied up. And the ties were supposed to, look perfect. So in terms of the aesthetics of the school, yes, you had to definitely be wearing uniforms and adhere to rather strict rules of demeanor. In terms of speech, I think that's a very important point. We were definitely told from the very beginning that that's definitely comes as part of growing up then, that whatever you would hear at home, you would make sure that you will not repeat it at school. And for instance, my father would actually listen to Radio Free Europe in the night. And what was very particular about it is that my parents were living in a two-room apartment, not two-bedroom, two-room apartment. One day was their bedroom, one was my bedroom. And in order for him to let my mom sleep, he would come into my bedroom where he had his own desk, and he would actually put the Radio Free Europe on while he was still working. So it's kind of strange, a situation. I really wonder how that information from Radio Free Europe, got to percolate my unconscious. Because sometimes I would wake up and listen to the news, and he was totally not aware of that. So anyway, what I'm saying is, yes, it was very important to make sure that you would not talk about your parents or whatever parents would say at home, because you knew that you would get in trouble and they could also go to jail, basically. It's very simple.
So as part of a broader thing, though, so at what age did you start to realize that you couldn't travel freely, that there was a securitate, that there was an apparatus of state that was quite repressive? Was that something that slowly emerged, or did you sort of have an awakening at a sudden point?
I would say it was both. I think there was definitely a clear idea that you have to be very careful what you say to friends. At the same time, my parents were not dissidents. So they were just ordinary people. However, if you are going to really say that your father will listen to Radio Free Europe, that would be a serious problem. What I do remember specifically was an episode in which my father had a visitor. So first of all, just to contextualize, they didn't have a phone, right? Anyone could knock on the door and then you would open the door and invite them in. So, my father was a big stamp collector. And so he would actually have lots of visitors to show and exchange those stamps. And the one moment I do remember, it was a weekend because everyone was at home. And someone knocked at the door. My father opened the door. That man came in. They shook hands, and my father invited him to so-called his office, which was also my bedroom, to show him the stamps. It turned out that this guy was a local official related to the secret police. And the radio on my father's desk was obviously set on this frequency that anyone would know that there was the way how you catch Radio Free Europe. It was not a frequency for like normal Romanian news. So my father was freaking out for the entire visit, and we were not aware of. So the guy left.
I'm not surprised. Yeah. I'm not surprised at all.
So they exchanged stamps. The guy left. We will never know if he noticed that and he didn't say anything. But my father definitely freaked out for many months after that visit because he always expected that someone else would knock at the door. And this time he will actually be taken out from the apartment.
And did you know of people that were taken away?
No, I don't. I did not know. Or at least, yeah, I didn't. And I was a kid, right? Even if something happened, I think it would have been quite a radical experience. So maybe my parents probably would not have told me that. But no, I didn't hear anything about anyone happening something like this to anyone during the time I grew up.
Do you still have your father's stamp collection?
Actually, no. He still has some. He stopped collecting stamps a long time ago. Much later, I realized why he started collecting stamps. It was a way for him to start exchanging letters with people living in the West. So what's interesting is that his stamp collecting hobby turned out to be very beneficial at the end of the regime. Precisely because he was able to connect to make pen pals with people, especially in France. He learned French just for the sake of exchanging those letters and those stamps, which is quite amazing. And then at the end of the regime, everyone was like, oh my gosh, Romania, revolution, we have to find ways to really help those guys. And so we started getting lots of French chocolate from these guys. And so we ate lots of chocolate in 1990. So because of this stamp for people of France.
That's not such a bad way, is it, to collect stamps?
Yeah, that's true.
Very clever.
Yes, I know. I don't think he expected. I think he really wanted to do something that would be definitely apolitical, but would also give him a taste of, you know, a certain kind of aesthetic that was definitely not socialist.
You would have turned about 14 in 1989 when the Ceausescu regime finally fell. Mm-hmm. How do you become aware of that? And what do you feel when, in a way, all those certainties started to disappear overnight?
Well, so I do remember very distinctly the day in which it fell. It was December 22nd, and I was supposed to go to school. And I turned on the TV, and I do remember that I was shocked. There was no one at home. I do remember that. My parents were at work. I don't remember exactly what day of the week it was, but it definitely was a weekday. I can definitely check the calendar. And I turned on the TV because I wanted to know whether my watch worked or not. I want to make sure I will be on time. So I turned on on the TV because I knew there would be news, and then I wanted to just see what time it was. And then I see these people on the TV, and I just didn't understand what was going on. And I was by myself in the apartment with no phone. Everything was just so strange. So I got out of the apartment and I went to see a friend of mine who was living in an apartment building right next door. And I could see that everything, like the entire, you know, atmosphere had radically changed. It was such a strange sensation. Everyone was running on the street. Some people were even smiling, but with a smile that I had never seen in my life, like a bright, you know, open, radical smile. And some people were, you know, scared. You can see their eyes. And I was really trying to understand what was going on. And then I went to my friend, and then her mother told me that the regime ended, that Ceaușescu fled. And then my mom came back from work. And then, and I do remember very distinctively that we tried to go to see my grandparents. My grandparents lived on the other side of the town. So my parents lived in so-called industrial complex. It was a neighborhood of a new neighborhood of apartment buildings that was the outskirts of the town. So we had to travel all across the city, the town, to take the bus and get there. But what happened is that we got on the bus, and as soon as we were leaving this neighborhood to get into the other part of the town, into downtown, and then later eastern part where my grandparents lived, we had to pass by a military station. And we started actually being shot at. So it was so strange. The bus stopped. The bus driver said, "I cannot go. You guys come down, get out of the bus, and get back to the first apartment building that was basically very close to the bus." So the bus stopped, and then we had to basically call all of us, including my mom and me. We got into the first entrance of this apartment building. We knock at the apartment that was at the first floor, and everyone from the bus got into this apartment. It was so strange. And much, much later, we never really know who were the people who shot. No one was really shot. No, there was no blood. But later, when I actually went to visit this place again, I could still see the traces of the bullets in the wall of this apartment building.
Why did they shoot at you?
Well, that's a very good question. I think it was very much part of the chaos that was meant to be, provoked during the so-called revolution. I mean, now we know, right, 30 years later, now we know that the so-called terrorists did not exist, that, in fact, it was much more of a internal coup d'etat. Between the former communists and the more marginal communists, who actually were able to take power and pretend that they were democratic politicians, and what was revolution and the time where so many people were in fact really shot and killed, this was a chaos that was actually politically provoked.
It's fairly well accepted that the Ceaușescu regime was one of the most repressive regime in the Soviet bloc. How did it feel in the weeks and months after there'd been that internal civil war and the regime had changed?
Well, I think it was important to make a distinction between how it felt in provincial small towns like mine, and in important points like Bucharest and other larger cities. We really lived the revolution, the so-called revolution, vicariously on the TV screen. We were basically glued to the TV screen, that's what we would do for many weeks. For definitely the first month or so, everyone was really watching TV almost nonstop because the TV finally was on nonstop. I think someone who lived in Bucharest at that very same time probably had a totally different experience. Probably there was a much stronger pressure to go in the street. Probably many of them went on the street precisely because of this pressure. Many of them, unfortunately, were shot because they actually chose to join the street protest and chose to, to really finally, exercise their right to free speech.
At this point, I think we should talk about the book that you've written and about how the authorities used architecture to promote the aims and image of the regime. It's a very interesting book, Socialist Heritage, the Politics of Past and Place in Romania. Can you tell us a little bit about the book and what you look at in that book?
Sure. So the book is, first of all, it's an academic book. It's a what I would call historical ethnography. It focuses particularly on one specific place in Romania, and that is a historic neighborhood in Bucharest called the Old Town. And what's very particular about this old town, this neighborhood, is that it kept having very distinct political meanings at different moments during communism and after communism. So I look at this neighborhood and I'm trying to understand the broader political changes by the ways in which this neighborhood is becoming valued, is dismissed, and then revalued by different political actors, as I said, at different moments. When I talk about the relationship between political agenda and architects, I want to definitely highlight that it was definitely a very sinuous relationship, in the sense that there was never necessarily a top-down. It was something that, yes, the architects had to really be, you know, paying lip service in a political way. But at the same time, more often than not, the politicians had to eventually be willing to leave the last, you know, the last decision, the final decision, to the experts. When it came to the changes in the urban fabric and the transformation of cities into socialist cities. So there was a continuous negotiation throughout the communist times between the experts and the politicians about how to transform much more heterogeneous cities into this pinnacle of socialist modernity.
And what would the pinnacle of socialist modernity look like? Would it look like the House of the People? Is it that kind of grand gesture of a building?
Well, I think also this pinnacle of socialist modernity changed according to the times. In the 50s, when the communists came to power in 47, they knew for sure that in order for them to gain, you know, to gain legitimacy from the population, a key point for them was to provide housing, to provide cheap and good housing to the workers, to the working class, and to the citizens in general. And the archives are very clear. The primary sources that I found, the archives are very clear about that. It was a key priority for the regime. So pinnacle of socialist modernity at that specific time in the 50s and 60s was to transform cities that seem to be far too heterogeneous from an aesthetic perspective into something that looked modern, looked clean, linear, functional. There is a very important change in the 80s when Ceausescu is becoming increasingly dictatorial, and therefore there is no more interest in the needs of the people. So it's a pure dictatorship. They just basically want to really pursue the dream of like showing how grandiose the regime is. And of course, all the resources are actually pumped into this very debated and very controversial megalomaniac apparition, which is the People's House.
I read somewhere that you can go on a tour of the House of the People and you'll walk 2 kilometers on the tour, but you'll only cover 5% of the building in those 2 kilometers, which must give some measure of the scale of that building. We'll put some information in the show notes. Yeah. About that. I think it's now called the Palace of the Parliament, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's also fascinating to think about the symbolical dimension of in which, you know, a former symbol of power of the former regime then becomes another symbol of power for the basically the so-called, you know, like it's for democracy. So there is, I think it speaks to some much more subtle continuities between the communist regime and the post-communist period.
And what's your journey through that landscape from being a young teenager through to leaving Romania ultimately to follow your career. But how do you plot a route through the changing landscape of Romania in the 80s and 90s?
Oh, I see. No, yes, I definitely stayed at school in Romania. I basically finished my, my first leg of education in Romania before coming to the US to pursue a PhD in anthropology and history. So my educational trajectory was I finished high school, I came to Bucharest for college, I got in, and I actually graduated with a major in sociology. And then after that, I worked for a few years. I actually worked during college, and I also worked after college. And then I applied and I got in to pursue a master's at the Central European University in Budapest. And so I went there for a year. And then from there, I actually applied for pursuing a PhD program in the US. And by that time, my English was much better. I was able to write and speak fluently. And I also was able to rely on a lot of help, institutional help from the professors there and the tutors to be able to really, create strong applications so I would be able to actually pursue this PhD.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Did high school change a lot for you as you went back to school in January 1990? Was it a very different place, or did it keep on going in very much the same vein as before?
Yeah, that's actually an interesting question. I think it was a combination. I mean, most of the teachers had actually, right, were the same teachers that taught the same history or the same kind of curriculum before. Some of them were definitely very much nostalgic for the older regime, especially the older ones. I do remember that there were some new teachers who just graduated and then college and then came back to teach. And it was quite a difference between those new teachers or younger teachers who at that time probably were like, what, mid 25, 26, 24. So they just finished college and the older generation. So, of course, but I don't remember so much. High school for me was a rather strange time. I was reading a lot. I was very much by myself. So, yeah.
When you look back now, I mean, from a perspective of 2020, back at the years that you spent in Romania, what do you feel about that, about the country, a country that has, in many respects, a difficult past? One thinks of the orphanages. How do you feel today looking back?
Well, I think it's important to understand that people also had fun during times that from outside seem to be extremely dire. That people really found lots of compromises in order to, you know, they probably oscillated between continuously finding compromises and trying to live a dignified life. So this is how I see it from my perspective as an adult now, looking back at my parents' generation, for instance. I think also that many people growing up at that time developed a certain kind of resilience that was turned out to be much more helpful lately. But I also feel a deep sadness about especially people and young people who died in 1989 and during the shootings on the street, precisely because there was never a serious reckoning with the loss of so many young lives and possible futures that were cut short. So precisely because after 1989, for more than a decade, to be honest, many of the people who had been part of the political apparatus before 1989 still hold on to positions of power and managed to actually, make fortunes with the insider information that they had about the property of the former communist state. So I think it's a kind of a bittersweet feeling that I'm thinking right now, that I'm like experiencing right now, looking back at that time.
Certainly a lot of what I read about Romania, there is always a desire to look forward and not back. Do you think that's uniquely Romanian, or is that more general?
I think it's probably the way in which any society will have to really find itself into, especially a society that had experienced a very traumatic past, it has to find a middle ground between negotiating the memory of that past and also finding a way to move forward, right? So the generation after me, people who are coming of age right now in Romania, based on the conversations I had with especially some children of my friends, they are finding themselves and thinking of themselves as being very much European. They have some interest in that communist past. Some others feel it like truly a totally different planet. It has nothing to do with them and with their life and with their generation. So, I think I would say that finding a way to reckon with that past, but also focus on the future is kind of, it's a more general mechanism of social mechanism of coping, and it's not necessarily particular to Romania.
Do you go back often?
Yeah, in general, I try to go there every summer. I mean, it is my my research place, right? So, I mean, I turned the country of my birth into one of my research sites. I have conducted a lot of ethnographic research and archival research in many places in Romania. But not in my hometown, I have to say.
What is ethnographic research?
Anthropological research, basically field work. I conducted some interviews, conversations, participant observation. A part of my current project, my future second book, will rely much more on field work that I conducted in two locations in Transylvania a few years ago.
Okay. And I saw they did some work with some of the Roma community that immigrated to the United States. Was Romania a broad ethnic mix while you were growing up there?
Yes. Yeah, so Romania has a long history of being one of the countries that included different regions with very different past and also very different ethnic groups, including Roma, but definitely Jews, Armenians, Hungarians, Germans. I'm talking about different regions in Romania right now, right? So Transylvania has a different history precisely because it was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The Roma in Romania are definitely an important group. Unfortunately, it is also a group that has been radically marginalized politically, economically, socially throughout history. And only now, more and more Roma intellectuals and activists are trying to really claim their rights, and they are trying to really claim a political visibility for this group.
Was there a class structure in Romania?
Yeah, but it was, I wouldn't say it was a class structure, but it felt like a class structure. And it was, it was rather a dichotomy. It was between they, what was called they, and us. And depending on where you were standing, they were the opposite, which means if you were a political, if you were part of the political apparatus, or your parents were part of the political apparatus, they definitely had access to an amazing range of goods and opportunities that were not available, not even the dreams of the ordinary people. So in terms of class, right, it was like an allegedly classless society, open for the benefit of all. And I have to say this, indeed, many people went to school and managed to actually get to have a better life than their parents, who were, say, villagers before the Second World War. So it's important to also take that into consideration. At the same time, if you were part of the ordinary citizens, your life became increasingly miserable as the regime actually continued to unravel, especially in the late 70s, throughout 1980s.
I mean, I think we should mention the secondhand clothes market and the shipping of that around. How did that come about and what did it mean for you?
So this is definitely a very important moment in the early 90s, I would say. I haven't really followed that in terms of research. So I'm just going to be speaking only on my personal experience, based on my personal experience. So the secondhand clothing market boomed in Romania in early to mid-90s. And that was because suddenly anyone would be able to really find a great pair of jeans, like a really nice, barely worn or more worn leather jacket. You would pay not so much for it. And just putting it on felt like you would really, you know, feel closer to the West. And that's very important for generations who were not able to leave the country, who were not able to really just even imagine that they would ever visit Western Europe. Just wearing that pair of jeans that looked great and not be known, you know, in your deep heart that basically was worn by a Westerner was quite something. It was quite a political performativity, if I put it this way, an academic way.
So you could feel that you could relate to what was going on outside of the country, I guess.
Right. I mean, I have a very special story. So I was dying to have a pair of jeans. And then there was the first second-hand clothing shop that appeared in my town. And my grandma gave me some money. And I basically used them all that money to buy the second-hand pair of jeans, which were great. And so I was super happy. I went back to her and I told her, "Grandma, look what great jeans I got." And she was like, "I cannot believe you wasted my money, you know, hardly won money on a secondhand, you know, clothing." Basically, she would not understand why would I really waste so much money on something that had been worn before. Whereas for me, it was like fantastic in so many ways. It had been worn by a Westerner before. They look great. I look great. Everything was perfect.
I visited the USSR in 87, and it's interesting what we thought was a commodity, you know, a knockoff copy of a Top Gun cassette or an old pair of jeans was suddenly in such high demand, and mm-hmm. they were sorted for the stuff that we wanted that was, you know, commoditized to them, you know, a massive Soviet flag or a, I think maybe even a bottle of vodka would have changed hands. You know, it's interesting because I think that people always want what they can't have.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. I mean, this was basically took years and decades of longing for something that you could only barely get a glimpse of just if you were able to see a Western magazine or a Burda or, you know, this kind of German catalogs. So, yeah, absolutely.
What was on Romanian TV up before in 89? Was it a very dry diet of state.
I do remember. And that's why when I said that I was checking the watch at the moment of the when I found out that the regime collapsed, was that they would have only news from 12 to 1 to 2. That's it. 2 hours of television of news about what Ceausescu did and how grand he is and everything about him, basically. There was the only thing that was indeed interesting was a 1 hour per every Saturday evening, which was a certain kind of combination of short documentaries with it was basically educational material. And in Romanian, it was called Tele Encyclopedia, which is basically the TV encyclopedia. And they would really have short documentaries about various kinds of things, especially play. So it was profoundly apolitical. And precisely because it was so profoundly apolitical, as long as it was about, you know, geological times or things that would not be connected to recent history, it would pass. And so it would pass through censorship. And everyone would be able to finally see something that had no political dimension whatsoever.
But there were no imported TV shows.
There were some cartoons. there were some actually Soviet cartoons. They were pretty funny. some Russian movies, some Soviet movies, I'm sorry. I also don't remember so much because basically there was so little that you could see that you basically would not really turn on the TV. That's why I was really reading a lot because there wasn't really much to see. It was not, I wouldn't call it television. It was just basically somehow, I don't know, like a portal to political ideology in full display, interspersed with some documentaries about, I don't know, Pleistocene from time to time. That's a good description of what it was and it was also, of course, only one channel. So yeah, that was what so-called television was in communist Romania, my time. I wanted to say that I actually ended up writing a poem for Ceausescu, which was published. And that piece of that poem was so strange because I didn't really realize it was published. And then a teacher came to me with, there was this very specific magazine meant for the pioneers. And then they said, "Is this you?"
Was it an apolitical poem or was it very political? What did you say in it?
So it was a praising Ceausescu because I think it's fascinating to think of how ideology works for kids' minds. So I knew he was really a dictator. Maybe I wasn't really using that term, but I knew it was pretty bad. At the same time, I would go to this literary circle where we would just write poems. And I would write poems about birds and like various kinds of plants and things that were not political. But then I also wrote about a poem about Ceausescu because I also saw other poems written by other kids about Ceausescu. It was a kind of the equivalent of the Lego competition then, right? And so I submitted those poems and they ignored the poem about birds, which I thought it was excellent. But they posted the poem about Ceausescu.
So not only are you a published academic, but you're also a published socialist poet.
Unfortunately, I have to own it. Yes, definitely.
Do you have the poem with you?
I don't remember it, and I don't think my mom kept it. So,
oh,
no.
Shame.
Yeah, I do remember one thing though, that I actually used, you know, like kids' poems. I used specifically one line where I said something about his. His feverish mind. In Romanian, it's actually mintea înfierbântată, which can also be actually really interpreted as basically you are, you know, inebriated.
Yeah.
And they changed it to his flower-like mind, which in Romanian is mintea înflorită. So there was a very important editing, you know, element there that they had to really change. But yeah, I will always remember that. That was kind of pathetically funny. How can I put it? But this way.
It's such a shame that you haven't got a copy of that.
Yeah, I don't think I can find it. I'm sorry.
It'll be in some archive somewhere.
I'm sure. I think if I can go to the National Library of Romania, and I also have to remember which year, because I was probably 11-ish,
yeah,
sometime like that, 11, 12, because it's when I was going to this literary circle.
So now we know why your grandparents got to keep their house, because you wrote poems praising Ceausescu.
Exactly. That's the hidden connection.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the hidden connection. It took me so many decades to finally put the two and two together.
There's further information such as photos and videos in our episode notes, which will show as a link in your podcast app. Now, this show wouldn't exist without our generous Patreons, so I want to thank one and all of them for their support. You can very easily become a Patreon by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. And you can also join our Facebook group, where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Thanks very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.